Thank you to those who read, and thank you to Linda Clare for being our timer. Our speakers will share for 15 minutes each, then we will open the floor for 3-minute shares. Please follow these timing guidelines to allow more attendees to participate in the workshop. Give your first name, where you live, how long you've been in OA, and length of abstinence and or maintenance. So our first speaker is Ms. Cordelia Y. Cordelia, I have never met you before, but I'm so excited and happy to be able to hear more of your story, to hear any of your story, and to hopefully know you better by the end of this workshop. Ms. Cordelia.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for Ms. Ann for asking me to be a part of this wonderful workshop. I'm grateful to do service. Let's see, my name is Cordelia Y. I've been in program since 2015. I've been continued absent since 2018. I had a relapse from January 2017 July 2017 through January 2018. Since then, I've had wonderful, great abstinence. And what else? Oh, I'm in Florida. I'm in West Palm Beach, Florida. And when it gets cold up there, I don't. So I'm so grateful. I don't like cold weather. I don't like shoveling snow. It's so overrated. That's why I'm in Florida. I've only been here 11 years. So my story. So I came into OA in 2015, as I mentioned, and how I came into the rooms. I had been yo-yoing diet. I have done Weight Watchers. I've done Medifast. I've done Atkins. I've done the only eat oranges all day diet. I've done cabbage soup diet. I've done everything. And so at that time in my life, my weight was going back up because, and I've done walking so much that I thought I would lose the weight based on how much I walked that day. And so all those kind of things. And then my body started gaining weight back and I started getting afraid. So I looked up, online what it meant to be eating foods compulsively. And the magic thing is that OA came up and there's a list. I don't know if it still exists on the website, but there's a list of questions that it asks you. And I answered, I think, 9 out of 10 of those questions that applied to me. And so I knew that that was my answer. Then I looked down even lower and the person who had sponsored me in Al-Anon was running the group that was on the online, and it was down the street from my home. So I believe that was a God shot for me to be a part of OA. I came into OA literally just to lose weight. I didn't know anything about emotional sobriety, none of that other stuff that, I call coming into OA ultimate bait and switch, because I came in because it was my weight. But since coming in, it has been because of the emotional maturity, sobriety, and peace and calm and serenity that I've been gifted through this program. When I came into the rooms, I had no idea that I was feeding myself because of traumas that my life had gone through. I'd gone through several traumas from the time when I was in my mother's womb. I was not wanted by her husband because I wasn't his child, to the time of literally I've had relationships. My first husband had other women pregnant at the same time, so I'm going through emotional abuse. Second husband was a crack addict, going through a whole lot of emotional abuse. I was a hostage at one time. So much of my recovery is because I was feeding myself, soothing myself through the traumas that I had gone through. And it's only through this program that I realized that literally God had begun to heal me of the pains of my past, heal me of the pains of the memories, heal me of the pains of what was done. I watched my mother when I was 15 try to commit suicide. And so all these traumas in my heart, I didn't realize that I'd been trying to squelch them, eating my way into oblivion. And so the gift of being in program for me today, this day, this moment, this hour, is the gift of peace and serenity. I literally, before I came into the rooms, my thoughts were so intrusive that I wanted to commit suicide because they never would give me a break. My body image, my negative inner speak, I didn't like what I looked like, didn't like what I felt like. And what I really realized is I was running from me. I was running from me, but coming into the rooms, God has allowed me to love me, accept me, like me, appreciate me, and all the radiant being that I am. So going forward, I'm now in recovery, and some of the memories that God has released me from are all the pains that I've had. I was bullied coming up, said I was a nothing. I've had one of my mother's boyfriends try to molest me. I had another one of my mother's boyfriends that was, "You'll never be anything." So all of this stuff in my head really, really reached into me. And that was the life that I was living, just not liking what was happening. In these rooms, if I never say another word, the gift of this program is the serenity that comes from working it, allowing God to bring up the memories, but to heal from the memory. The gift of this program is the healing of the memories that have come. The memories of being bullied, the memories of watching my mom, the memories of all those things no longer haunt me. They are now treasures that I can now have compassion for myself and for those that had those issues. That's huge for me because, you know, as I'm in recovery, sometimes I want to hold on to a grudge because, you know, it feels good to hold on to it. It feels comfortable. You know, I've heard in a meeting that there is a golden turd that I'm holding on to because, you know, that. But really, I was harming myself and never had an opportunity to really be free, really be the true self that God created me to be. So the gift of this program for me is really the serenity and peace that God has gifted me with, and just the relationships of being in the program. And one of the other gifts that I think I was asked to mention is how being in the rooms of Black, Indigenous, and people of color have catapulted my recovery. And that has been the blessed gift for me of the past year, because prior to being in the predominantly Black rooms, is I needed to shape shift. I needed to code switch. I was usually the only Black IP in the pot of rice. So, you know, I just kind of not said really how I felt, just to go along to get along. But now I don't have to do that. I get to be my true free self. And I've got friends that reach out to me now. I wasn't getting that before. I have friends that reach out to me, text me, call me. We have a connection, and that's something that I yearn for. So now in these rooms, I have that connection. I have friends on the West Coast, in Canada, UK, that I can reach out to, that reach out to me. So that has been one of the gifts, and it has catapulted my recovery so that I don't feel like I need to code switch. I don't feel like I need to shape shift and be something that I'm not trying, okay, to be, because, oh, hey, I need the recovery. I need this. I need the rooms. But it feels great to be in rooms where I see mine, that mine see me, and that we get each other. I think that's all I got. Thank you for allowing me to share, everybody.
Cordelia, thank you so, so much for your share. That was really wonderful. That was really wonderful. Our next speaker is Miss Nanette. I'm so happy that you're here today, and I can't wait to hear what you have to say. Thanks so much, and I'll turn the floor over to you.
Okay, my name is Nanette. I'm a compulsive overeater. I live in West Hollywood, California, and I've been in OA 46 years, and I have 38 years of abstinence. I came to OA mostly to lose weight, to catch a man who would then fix me. And but I could tell from the very first meeting that there was something here that I could stay here for the rest of my life. And the one pitch that I remember from my very first meeting was a woman who was trying to parallel park, and she did it and she accidentally backed into a fire hydrant, which broke, and the water went spewing everywhere, and she was embarrassed. And she didn't talk about food once. And I could see that you could talk about anything here. And everybody in my, I come from, I'm Chinese American. And when I started kindergarten, I didn't speak English. We spoke Chinese at home. And then I was in kindergarten, everybody looked different. They were all white and they spoke this other language, which I didn't know. And in those days, they didn't have English as a second language classes or anything. So the way you learn English is you just had to pick it up. So I picked it up and that was it. So the family, the inside language was Chinese, the outside language was English with all these foreign people in the US. So, so I came to OA and I came in with a diet mentality. And so recovery for me was a perfect diet because I didn't have any recovery. I only had the fantasy of what recovery I thought was. You ate the right things at the right time with the right portion all the time, 100% of the time. And so it took me 8 years to get abstinence. And 8 years, I was abstinent 8 times. My first long-term abstinence was 3 days. And then I couldn't stand it because it was a stringent diet because I wanted to be perfect. Although I didn't think I was a perfectionist because I thought perfectionists were perfect. So I couldn't meet that standard. And my second abstinence was 5 days, which was a fast. I didn't eat anything at all. And I had to stop that fast because I was starting to think I never needed food ever in my whole life, which is a crazy thought. And I knew it was a crazy thought, but I knew I thought it. So I had to like quit that diet. And then I had 4 days, 15 days, 17 days, 23 days, and 27 days. 27 days was abstinence number 7. And my current abstinence, which is abstinence number 8, I have 38 years. So there's a big difference between 27 days and 38 years. So what happened? Every diet I went on was a secret diet because OA is not a diet club. So I didn't use the word diet, but it was the secret diet. It was for the purpose of making me perfect and losing weight. And by 8 years, I could tell it wasn't working because the most I could get together was 27 days. So I had to change. And so this is what I did. I made an abstinence large enough so that I could do it, which was this: meals at mealtime with life in between. And I put it that way. And by the way, life in between included popcorn at the movies. So I put it that way because I didn't want to eat breakfast at 12:01 a.m. I just wanted to look relatively normal, whatever the size of the meal. And in spite of myself, I started to lose weight. So one of the first things I realized was that I had the disease of perfectionism. And that in me, the disease of perfectionism was really strong. It was as strong as the disease of compulsive overeating. And I knew, in fact, they were conjoined twins. They were joined. If one twin got a cold, they both got a cold. If one twin took Tylenol, they would have Tylenol in both circulation systems because they were joined. And for me to recover from the disease of compulsive overeating, I had to also be willing, just willing, to recover from the disease of perfectionism because they were together. And so meals at mealtime, one of the things I realized, I had been to a commercial weight loss program before that at that time did not have points, but today has points. But when I started, it did not have points. So I knew how to put together food that would work, but I could never stay on that diet. So one of the first things I did in my current abstinence is this. I realized that when I went to a restaurant, I ate too many rolls, and it made me feel bad, that connection. So I said, okay, when I'm in a restaurant, and if they have rolls, I'll have one roll and one pat of butter, no matter which runs out first. And I put it that way because I would take a roll from the roll basket, open the little packet of butter, and finish the roll, and I have some butter left. Have to take up the second roll to use up that butter, but there wasn't enough butter for the second roll, so I have to open the second butter. And then to finish the second roll, and then there'd be some second butter left. So I have to take the third roll to use up the second butter, and it would just escalate like that. And so I had one roll and one pat of butter, no matter which runs out first, and then I ate the meal they served me in a restaurant. And it wasn't a small, restaurants do not serve small meals unless it's super expensive. But a regular restaurant has normal, like, lots. And I ate everything on that plate that I wanted to eat. Every grain of rice, the decorative lettuce, the parsley if I wanted it. Because I figured it was my portion. They served it to me. And that was not a diet at all. And that was another abstinent meal. In one restaurant I went to, they put a basket of rolls down and they were assorted rolls. So then I had this big debate, which one should I take? Does this look best, but it's smaller than that one? But what if the smaller one tastes better than the larger one? And I knew if I'm this going on this long-term, I had to not feel deprived. So I said I would have one roll of each kind. And there were three kinds. I had three rolls, and they all shared the same pat of butter because they didn't have different types of butter. And so that was another abstinent meal. And again, I ate everything. And one place that I worked at, we had, just so you know, I ate, we had 45 minutes for lunch. And we had 45 minutes for lunch so that we could leave work at 4:45 instead of 5. And so I would prepare a lunch, a brown bag lunch, healthy carrots, sandwich, everything, take it to work, put it in my desk. And when lunchtime came, it was too boring to eat. So then I went to the cafeteria on another floor of the building. They always had two specials, two main greases and four side greases to choose from. I would choose one of the main greases and I would choose two of the side greases and I ate everything. I was always a fast eater. And then I went on the first floor where they had a guy who sold newspapers, cigarettes, candy, and pre-made sandwiches. I would buy maybe two of those, a chicken, maybe a turkey and a tuna. And then I would eat those with a crust and the tuna would be soaked with, like, the tuna soaked into the bread. It was kind of soggy, but I ate the whole thing. And then I went back to my desk and there would be the lunch that I had abandoned. So I ate that one. And so I kind of didn't get, I had 45 minutes to eat lunch. I thought I had to eat for 45 minutes. And that was a normal day for me before recovery. So all those seven abstinences were, they were abstinence, but they weren't recovery. Any diet you go on is an abstinence, but they're not necessarily a recovery. So I never had a relapse. And in my current abstinence of now 38 years, I've never had a relapse because I crossed that invisible line into recovery. One of the things that, I think I have 5 minutes left. And
yes, you do.
Thank you. So, I'll just share my pizza story and then I'll share two more things and I'll be done. When I was practicing, my husband and I we would order a pizza about once a month. They would deliver it. It would be a large pizza with everything on it except anchovies. And then we'd get delivered home and he would have half, I would have the other half. And I would eat mine with a diet squirt. And I knew that when you're in recovery, you can't eat exactly the same way that you ate when you're practicing. But I wasn't willing to give up pizza. and I wasn't willing to give up a lot of pizza. So I said, okay, on my half, I'll take off one slice. I'm abstaining from that one slice of pizza and I'm having the rest of it. And that's what I did. They delivered it. I had my half. I took one slice out. That slice my husband can have if he wanted it. It could be for lunch the next day. I could put it down the garbage disposal. It simply wasn't mine for that meal. And that wasn't small eating. So for the first 2 years of abstinence, every time we had pizza, that's not how much I had. One slice less than a half. And something happened to me during the third year of recovery. I was suddenly willing to have less pizza. I was willing to have one slice more than a fourth. And sometimes one slice more than a fourth is exactly the same as one slice less than a half. But sometimes they cut it differently and it was less. And for the whole year, that's how much pizza I ate, one slice more than a fourth. And then the fourth year, something different happened. I was suddenly able to stop at just a fourth of a pizza. And that's how much I ate. I didn't want any more, although I still allowed myself one slice less than a half. And then currently, the last, I think, 8 years, I've become vegan. I don't eat animal products. And when I have pizza, it's the pizza, a vegetarian pizza, no cheese. And that's how much. I don't miss anything that's not on there. I don't miss the cheese. So I'm going to end by telling you how I see my abstinence. I see my abstinence like a forest. And the days, the trees in the forest are days, in the forest are days of abstinence. There are enough trees in the forest to make the forest a forest. But if there are sequoias, Christmas trees, firs, oaks, beautiful trees in this forest. But if I only look at the trees, I'll miss the rest of what's in that forest because it's more there than trees. There are waterfalls, streams, brooks, clover, California poppies, blue jays. And some, I don't look in the forest, some of these trees are tree stumps. They're dead. Their lightning hit it, it stopped growing, maggots crawling through them. If you hike over to that meadow, you'll find a grove of tree stumps. But if I believe a forest is God-given and God-made, which is true, I have to accept everything that's there. And if I determine that my recovery is God-given and God-made, I have to accept everything that's there, no matter what my personal opinion is. So if sometimes I think maybe I've broken my abstinence, I don't make a decision of whether I've broken it or haven't broken it for 3 to 6 months. And from now to 3 months, what if I haven't broken my abstinence in 3 months? If I look back and I haven't, I'm not going to ruin it now. I'm not going to mess up now. So I have to keep on keeping on. And that's why I have 38 years of abstinence. I have, So I was watching a PBS TV show on, and it was, they had an exercise guru on TV. And he was, after he gave his presentation, there was questions and answers from the audience. And one audience member asked, what is the best exercise? And his answer, the one you'll do. And that's a principle. The one you'll do is the one you can do. And so the one I can do is my abstinence, which is meals at mealtime with life in between. It's not a diet. And I don't have a problem with food, strangely enough. It's an issue that's a problem. Sometimes I eat more, sometimes I eat less. And 9 months ago, my husband passed away. He was sober in AA. He had 44 years of sobriety when he died. He had 27 years of abstinence. And thank you. I'll just end by saying food during that difficult time and currently difficult time simply is not an issue. It's not related to what happens in my life. So thank you so much for letting me share.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Nanette. It was wonderful to hear what you had to say. Our next speaker has chosen to remain anonymous, and we are so excited to hear her story. Please speak whenever you're ready. Thank you so much.
Hi. Hello, it's Nikita. Can you
hear me? I don't know who's speaking next.
It's anonymous from NYC.
Okay. So I come from New York City. I am a compulsive overeater. We have a timekeeper?
Yes.
Okay, could you tell me when I have 5 minutes?
Sure.
Thank you. Left.
Yes.
I chose to be on this platform anonymously because I may mention work issues, you know, and right now there's a case going on in my job for discrimination, and I don't know if I'll bring it up. Maybe I will, maybe I won't. So I want to thank everyone that spoke. I was in a meeting before this one, and the speakers were just amazing. You know, already I've been able to learn new things that I can apply to my abstinence. And for me, it is ever changing. You know, someone said, if I try to make it perfect, I will never be abstinent. And that's true for me. If I try to make that food perfect, it won't ever be. And that's been my experience. I came to OA in 1986. So I've been here for a very long time. Yesterday I had 10 months of abstinence, and I've relapsed, and I'm glad that almost every single person that I've heard at this meeting has relapsed as a background, you know, and that's it's entwined in their abstinence, because that's true for me. So what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. You know, food was always really important when I was a kid. My dad used to tell us how lucky we were that he was able to put food on the table, because when he was little, you know, there was no food. I don't know how true that is, because my family, they exaggerated. They, you know, I come from a dysfunctional, diseased family. But I knew that it was very important. And he used to go out on binges, and he was an alcoholic. He used to go out on binges. And when he was out, there was no provider. There was no one to bring in food. There was no one to feed us. My mother was from Brazil, and she didn't speak English well, and she wasn't acclimated to this country. And she would tell us that we were going to starve. She would say, I don't know what we're going to do, because there's no food and we're going to starve. And you know, and I was a kid, I was 6, 7 years old. I used to think that, yeah, I'm going to starve to death, and we're all going to starve to death. And you know, I remember also when things were okay, my father would, on Sundays, he would buy ice cream. And, you know, he would tell us how wonderful this was, that, and it was the only time we actually got together, not for meals, but for that treat, which I've learned that an alcoholic food is not a treat. But anyways, for me at that time, it was a treat, and he would bring us all together, and it was what it, you know, this is what we're sharing, and it felt like love. And for most of my childhood, those sweets felt like love. And my mom used to try to make me eat dinner, and, you know, food was not attractive to me. You know, what was attractive was what I thought was the treat. And today, if I try to restrict, it's almost a good chance that I'll be overeating. You know, so that word diet, I'm glad that it's not part of this program. Just food plan is part of this program. You know, and my dad would bring me stuff. He would give me things. I was his favorite. I was one of five. I was his favorite.
And, you know, and I was the youngest girl, and yet he would give me the whatever he bought, you know, a bag of this or a bag of that. And then he would say, if you want to share it, share it. And if you don't want to share it, don't share it. It's up to you. It's yours. And my sisters were older than me, and they would surround me, you know, like to intimidate me. But I didn't want to give it up. I didn't even want to open the bag because I thought I would waste it. It would go away. It would disappear. This bag of love. And they would say, well, we're not going to play with you. We're not going to talk to you. And from that early age, that food was more important than people. You know, that food was more important than playing with my sisters. That food was more important than, you know, they're even talking to me, because they would just stop talking to me, and I was on my own. But I felt okay because I had that bag of things, you know. And for a long, very, very long time, that gave me comfort. It really did. And, you know, still sometimes it does. And I think that for me, that's why it's so hard to put down food, because it still distracts me from tension. It still distracts me from anxiety. It still distracts me from worry. And it still is something that I could make a connection with you. So that's how it was in childhood. And then as a teenager, I switched my addictions to something else. And I started drinking, and, you know, I gave up. You know, that sugar thing, it was not that important to me anymore. But I could tell you that every single day after school, I would have a Snickers bar. Every single day without exception, I would have that. Anyway, so I'm going to fast forward a little bit. You know, I ended up in a rehab for my other addiction. And in rehab, you know, I saw that people were playing cards and they were gambling like packs of candy, you know, and there were a lot of men. And when they wanted to flirt with you, they would offer you candy. It was like, well, it became the new money, it became the new commodity, it became the new drug. And when they would say mealtime, because they would shout it out, there were about 55 of us, they would say mealtime. We were like a herd of animals, all of us running to that kitchen to get food. And then my food addiction began again. I put down the other thing, and my food addiction started. And I think in 30 days, I gained maybe like 20 pounds. And I'm going to say that, you know, when I was in my other addiction, I went down to a size 8 and I looked like a lollipop. I do not have the body of white America. I do not. My body is my body. It's from my culture. My hips are big. And when I was a size 8, I looked like a lollipop because my head looked bigger than my body. So I try to remember that, because there's certain sizes that are just not for me. You know, I am going to be comfortably a different size that's a lot bigger than that. So I remember going to work and weighing myself, and I remember having this pleasure with my body and not liking my body and hating my body. And you know, and I remember in high school, being that the food was not an addiction anymore, I got so much attention from boys. And I thought, oh, in order for me to be worthy, in order for me to be someone, I have to be thin. Because otherwise I'm nobody and I'm ignored and I'm nothing. You know, so my body became a real big, important part of who I thought I was. And so then I started gaining weight, and I was miserable, and I was working the steps in another program, and I was sponsoring people, and I had a sponsor, and I was going to a lot of meetings, and I was doing really well. But that food, I couldn't stop. And so someone told me about, no, I don't even know. I guess maybe I researched programs, you know, because I thought if I can drop the other stuff on 12 steps, then maybe I could drop the food. So I entered into mainstream OA, and the people, it was such a long time ago, it was 1986. The people didn't look like me. Their food was not like my food. I kept thinking that everything they ate was green, and that certainly was not my food. I rarely ate anything that was green. And I, my first fellowship, and this is where I'm going to talk about the difference.
That's 5 minutes.
Perfect. Thank you. This is where I'm going to share about the difference in fellowships. My first fellowship is multiracial, diverse. People took my phone number. People gave me hugs. I remember one guy came and picked me up and twirled me around. I used to get phone calls at night, and people just wanted to see where how I was doing. So I entered mainstream OA, and people told me, please don't call me at this time. If no one asked for my number, even though I said I was a newcomer. I went out and I reached out and I asked people for their number, and they would say, well, you can only call me from 8 to 9, or you can only call me from 7 to 8, or you can only call me on this day. It was almost like the opposite. And they told me, don't compare fellowships. And so I decided not to compare. I tried, but it was hard. It was really hard for me to get a sponsor. I kept trying. I would call people and they would never call me back, you know, and I'm not saying there were a lot of people that were very friendly and that were wonderful. And, but that connection, I really had to focus on the story, on the feelings and not the story, so I could connect. Anyways, being that I only have 5 minutes, I'm just going to say that I was so lonely in that program. And I tried, and I had sponsees at times. Their music was different from my music. I'm R&B, you know? And so it was like so different for me and so hard. And then the pandemic came and I was in a relapse. And someone started a meeting for relapsers. And I started going to that meeting. And the people in that meeting were gentle and they were kind, and I started to feel part of. And then they told me about Ebony, and I fell in love. I just fell in love with the Ebony meetings. I would call people and they would call me back. And I would say, wow. I would tell my friend, you know what? They called me back. And, you know, I was assertive in mainstream OA. And I would say, you know what? People don't call me back. And then my sponsor would say, oh, it's because of the disease. You know, it's because of the disease. Excuse me. We're isolators and the disease makes us be that way. But then I thought, but in other fellowships, they have the disease too. In Ebony, we have the disease too. Why is it so different in the mainstream OA? Why is their disease different than other people's disease? Anyway, so I have a sponsor in Ebony OA. We work the steps through the big book. We use the big book, which is amazing. And I've learned to look at my binge foods as alcoholic. They're not a treat. They're not something that I can have safely. My abstinence is not perfect. I'm sure as I go along, I will be given, I'm hoping, I'm praying, and I want to have the faith that I will give up more things, because it's not perfect right now. And I want to live with that imperfection. Perfectionism is a disease for me, because I never will get there, you know? And I just want to say that, you know, this is a blessing for me to have these meetings. It's God sent. I feel part of. I had COVID, I was sick, and people called me, you know, and in the other fellowship, the mainstream, I would disappear sometimes for weeks because I would just feel so disheartened. And no one would even call me to see if I had, you know, committed suicide or something. So I didn't have that connection. And that's just my experience. I know people that have a very different experience, people of color that have a very different experience. This is just my experience. And, you know, I'm just grateful to be here. I'm grateful for Zoom and that, you know, we started this up because there's so many people that need this program and want it. So, and I didn't share about my work, my job. So thank you for letting me share.
Thank you so much, Ms. Anonymous NYC. I really, really loved hearing your story and all of our speakers. This has just been a wonderful workshop. We will now have open sharing and questions. If you'd like to share or ask a question, please use the raise your hand function by clicking the reactions button at the bottom of the screen and choosing raise hand. If you're on your phone, find it under more than reactions. If you can't figure out how to raise your hand, type your name in the chat and say you want to share, or say your name in between shares if you're on your phone. Please recognize the timer when you hear it and quickly wrap up your share. The floor is now open, and I'm going to turn it over to our participant minder, Toby L.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And the first person to share is Ann G. Please unmute.
Hi, I'm Ann, a grateful recovering compulsive overeating and food addict, and I'm not going to be long because I shared before. thank you, Toby and Risa and all those on the line who are doing service this morning on the convention. I am so grateful for those three ladies that shared, and some of them I asked at the last minute, and they made a commitment that they would be here, and they are here, and I am so grateful. And those shares were just wonderful, and I just identified with so many things that were said. When Cornelius talked about the trauma that she had went through. And that's one of the things that I had a lot of trauma in this when I came in this program, and I anesthetized myself with food. And so I'm grateful today that I don't have to do that. And I was so grateful for when Annette talked about this is a God-given and God made us different, and everything that's in it, and keep on keeping on, because this program is not about food, it's about recovery. And diets don't last, and one of the definitions is diets die out. So I'm just grateful. And grateful for Anonymous from New York City. She came on at the last minute, and she decided that she would make a commitment to be here and share her experience, strength, and hope. And I am so grateful. And I'm just grateful that when I came in the room that I was the only one in here, but only person of color in the rooms many times. But I thought to myself, I don't care what the color they are or what they are. If they are from Mars, I want to recover. But I am so grateful, like she said, with all the BIPOC media that have been coming up. And I just love the BIPOC, the mainstream meetings, if it's a meeting. And I just can identify with all of the people in the rooms because we're all here for the same thing. I'm not above or below or less than anyone. I'm here for recovery, and that's what everyone else is here for. So I'm so grateful. I am so very grateful. And one of the things that that was said by New York Anonymous from New York was the binge foods when I was growing up was a treat. And when I grew up and I said, well, once I start having money, I'm gonna get all the treats I want. And that all those treats that I want put me into obesity, diabetes, and all of those health problems that went along with obesity. But I'm grateful today to be recovered from all of them one day at a time with this program. And this program is not a diet for me, but it's a way of life. And I am so grateful for this way of life. So thank you so much for allowing me to share. And with that, I will pass.
The next share is Jamila.
Hi, I'm Jamila, I'm a compulsive overeater. And I just wanted to know if the speakers could talk a little bit about, so one of my experiences coming into program was that I came in where I was really the only person of color in OA for a very long, well, really until I moved to Atlanta. having people that I could talk to about specific aspects of my experience and that I could identify with both the problem and the solution, particularly when it comes to like resentment around, you know, being stereotyped or having unfair treatment or things like that, that I had a really profound experience in steps 4 through 9 this time around, because I had a step guide who could help me with those aspects of my experience, where before I did not. In fact, I had sponsors tell me that, you know, that those things didn't exist, that I was being dishonest about those things that I was experiencing. So I'm just wondering if you've had any experiences dealing specifically with resentments around stereotypes and unfair treatment as a part of being BIPOC using the steps. So that's my question.
Hi, I'm Cordelia. I have a little bit of experience on that. When I came into the rooms, as I said, I was usually the only Black IP in the pot of rice. So I learned to not share my experience per se in that group, like I mentioned, code switching. But then I got into, I had a relapse. And at that point, I didn't care. I didn't care if she was purple. I needed somebody to help me. And so I reached out to my original sponsor, who was white, and she connected me with someone else, a Vision for You sponsor. And that sponsor helped me through the big book and got me to where I am today. I had an experience when I had this, I had started a meeting and I identified it because OA at the time had an identification of, you can identify the meeting as Black and whatever. So I had a meeting in here in Lake Worth, and I had one person call me and say she was offended that I had identified the meeting as Black. And I literally was trying to defend myself at the same time. And I had to say, you know what? I'm not willing to have this conversation with you. I reached out to my sponsor who is white, and she had never experienced Black only meetings. She didn't know they existed until I was able to share that I had started one with her and that I was identified. She literally went on OA to see that listing because she had experienced it. And she took me through the 10th step. And she apologized for the ignorance that she was experiencing. And she took me to the 10th step in order for me to move through having that one person who was probably frustrated because I didn't single her out. But she took me through the experience of 10th step to help me through the process of being frustrated because I'd gotten labeled, I'd gotten called all kinds of, well, what if we had a meeting for all white people? And my mom, like, you already do. So I can't really help you with that because they already do exist. But for us, we're usually singled out. So I had that experience, and that helped me to ease my resentment through working that 10 step with the process. And my sponsor, who is white, we've never even met, but she's, and I think she's in Tennessee, has been more open and understanding and accepting of my challenges. And I share honestly with her when I'm having some issues. Thank you for letting me share. I hope that answers your question. Sorry, I rambled on.
I'd like to share briefly, if I may. The poison is coming out now. And sometimes I hear the resentments that I have. I don't know that I was resentful while I was there, because I thought that was the norm. I believed what they told me. They said overeaters are more isolators than anyone else. So I thought that might have been one of the reasons why I didn't get the same embrace and welcome that I got from other fellowships. So I'm working the steps now, and I'm finding that I'm starting to see a balance. It's not just, you know, all poison, but I need to get that poison out because it's harmful, and those resentments kill me. Because I did have sponsors that were white and they were awesome and they were nice. I just never got invited to their home. It was just like a different thing, you know? But I'm learning to see the balance and not see myself as a victim and just see that it is what it is, or it was what it was, and that I don't have to go through that today. Thank you.
I'm Nanette, a compulsive overeater, and I have there's something I didn't share during my share, is that I have something else that makes me different. When I was 1.5 years old, I got polio, and it affected my right leg, and it's not strong enough to hold up my body. So I don't usually share this. In fact, I've never shared this on Zoom, but an in-person meeting, if I came to the meeting, you'd see me in two crutches. That's the only way I can walk. So I don't go to an OA meeting with disabled people. I mean, they're not there. I'm it. And also, I'm usually it as being Asian too. And so I don't talk about disability when I do a 3-minute pitch or even leading a meeting. I concentrate on OA stuff. But there was one particular meeting that I went to that was particularly loving. The person who started the meeting, you could tell her anything in the world and she would get it. And she was white and Jewish. So I worked out some of my disability stuff in that meeting, and lots of other things. But there's many parts of me that I work out in many meetings. And my first sponsor was white and Jewish. I had many sponsors of record, but I never used them. And then I had another sponsor who's also white and used to be a nun. And then my current sponsor is half Asian and half Black. And I didn't pick her because I didn't know she was Asian at all. And I didn't pick her because she was Black, but because she was honest about herself. And I appreciated that kind of stuff, that she owned herself. Whatever parts of her, she owned her mistakes at work, whatever. So OA has a lot of meetings, especially in the Los Angeles area. And for the most part, even though when I started kindergarten, I didn't speak English, when I started into my first OA meeting, I was the only Asian there, but I felt totally part of. Even though I was new at sharing, I knew that you guys had something I never experienced on the outside, and that I could be here little by little and discover myself. Because every time I shared a 3-minute pitch, I owned a part of myself. So I used OA meetings as a tool. Most of the massive people I go to meetings with are white. And it's not a problem because I have so many parts of me that needs working on. So that's it. I hope that's helpful.
Thank you so much. And I see Jackie has her hand up.
Hi, I'm Jackie, compulsive overeater. I've been in program since August of 1999 here in the Metro Atlanta area. And this is not a question, it's just a comment. You know, most of the meetings that I've gone to in OE have been mostly white, which wasn't uncomfortable for me because most of the schools that I went to growing up, I was usually one of a few people of color. So I didn't feel out of place because that's how I felt in normal life anyway. But what I will say for this is prior to OA, even though I had gone to school with, you know, mostly white children growing up in a white university, I didn't really get to know white people beyond just being in class with them. I would, you know, go to class with them, but I wouldn't really talk to them outside of class, you know. And so coming to OA helped me to know people beyond just what you see in like a professional setting and in class. And I started, and then I took what I learned in OA, outside of OA, and I started to develop real friendships with people of different races. And I'm not sure if I would have gotten that, even though, like I said, I was in school with with white people all day long. I don't think I would have gotten that outside of OA. And that's been very beneficial for me. And it's not just white people, but, you know, gay, lesbian, you know, people from different diverse groups. I feel like being in OA has enabled me to see beyond the different labels that we wear. And we do have differences in how we, you know, my family, even though I'm Black, my family is Jamaican Black, which is different from American Black. So I've been able to, you know, expand my OA horizons in and outside of the room. So thanks.
Thank you. Next is Cal.
Hey, Toby. Thank you. Thank you for your service. And a couple of things. I've been in the program, both programs. I'm a twofer, lucky to be a twofer, and some in two programs. And I've seen the change over the 30 years that I've been in both programs. And certainly the fact that we're even having this discussion and in the AA program, which was predominantly male driven, there was one dynamics. In the OA program, which is predominantly female driven, is a different dynamics. And the bottom line is, and I've heard a thread of it and everybody's sharing, is survival and recovery. However, I have to acknowledge there is cultural difference. Not only, you know, there's cultural difference. We don't stop being our culture ourselves because we walk in the rooms. We bring it in the rooms with us, like everything else we bring in the rooms. And the fact that we're discussing it and acknowledging it and putting it out on the table. And first time I attended, just as an aside, the Ebony meeting in LA, I was like blown away. Like, what? They got something like this? I mean, it was different, but it was a cultural thing. Part of it's cultural. And I don't think anybody comes in not wanting to, you know, to do what they can do to recover. As a male, I have, you know, over a lot of times it may be the cultural thing, the ethnic thing, and a lot of times it's the male thing. I had to adjust because of the system we live in, this patriarchic, male-dominated system. So I had to make some adjustments and still have to make adjustments. I go off on my male tantrum, like, you know, I'm the big banana in the room and I have to make adjustments. And so I love the fact that we have this diversity. I love that we've grown from those founders to the point where we do have a meeting not on the West Coast like the Ebony meeting, because I just didn't even think anything like it existed. But here, I'm glad for the meetings we have in Atlanta. And I just think it's something that we've grown with. And again, I want to thank you guys for having this forum. I want to thank the participants. And as one guy who's been saved by being around you ladies, keep going and keep doing the good work you're doing. And with that, I'll pass.
Thank you for your share. Next is Linda Clare.
Hi, everyone. I just want to express how I feel about this meeting and being in Atlanta. With all the shares in the meeting, I thought, well, I'm glad I'm in Atlanta and some of these prejudices don't exist. And then I thought, maybe I'm just naive and not well informed. My church has helped me to be more informed, more sensitive to African Americans and all ethnicities. For example, in a group of people, I'll notice that there's only two Black people there with all us whites, or a group of people will sit down and all the Blacks are over there and all the whites are over there. And those are things that I've become sensitive to. But when I've gone to my Atlanta OA meetings, it's like all that is wiped away and I don't see racial stuff. And I don't know if it's because I'm not sensitive or that we're blessed in Atlanta. I don't know. But to all the African Americans in Atlanta and other, I would like you to openly say if you feel prejudiced, because I'm not aware of it and I want to be aware of it. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you for your share. Marcella?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. My name is Marcella. I'm a compulsive overeater and bulimic. I'm from Costa Rica. I'm from Latin America. So I could feel different because of my accent, my language, and many things. But I feel in many ways, what I want to say is, after listening to these three ladies, I feel many things in common. I've been using their shoes also through my life. And this program has helped me to focus on positive things, on common things, and differences. We have to deal with them, but it is possible. So I keep coming because I need a program, and I need all of you, all the differences, all your experiences, all your shares. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. I believe we have time for one more share or someone to claim their seat or ask a question of the speakers.
Hi, this is BJ, and I guess I just want to claim my seat. glad to be here, glad to see this meeting, grateful for OA. I came in 1983. Most of the time, the only woman of color. But like so many of you all have shared, that was a footnote. I was sick needing help with this eating disorder. And it didn't matter about ethnicity to me at all. I needed help with this eating disorder. And I'm so grateful that OA was there. No one ran me out the room. and a lot of people reached out to me in the 80s, and I think I was fighting. You know, I have to own my own stuff. I was fighting, and I couldn't reach back. And I was standoffish and couldn't accept the love that was given to me. Sure, there were some, a small majority that were prejudiced, but for the most part, most people reached out to me and I was just not in a space to handle it very well. Today is a whole different story. I have worked on me for over 30 years, and people are people. People are people. I love them all. Whether they love me or not, I still love them all. And I'll just close with, I'm just so grateful to have found this program in the 80s. I don't think I would be alive without it. And I am very happy about the Ebony meeting on Saturday. I get to see 80 to 100 people that look like me. Sure, I connect at another level because I don't have to code, as someone said, you know. That was part of my culture in the 70s and 80s. You just coded. You just adapted to your environment. But when I go there, I'm truly BJ and don't have to censor anything I say or feel, which is wonderful. But overall, my experiences with OA has been beautiful. Thank you, and I'll hush.